I have only one regret about the editing of our prayer book. And that is the anonymity of its passages. Paragraph follows paragraph in proper order, but without any indication of author or place of origin or date. This gives to the whole prayer book an aspect of the disembodied, slightly ethereal. The Shema was written deep in biblical days. The Kaddish was phrased during the early centuries of the Common Era. Others of our prayers were written by our own contemporaries. One of the compelling urgencies and appeals of Judaism has been the grandeur and the continuity of our historic pilgrimage. And this time dimension has somehow been blanched out of these pages. I presume that the editors had in mind that prayer ought to be as broad and as universal in its appeal. That somehow if we would attribute each prayer to an author, it would lose an aspect of universality and some degree of reverence. But does anonymity enhance veneration? And must not prayer be grounded in the stuff of living experience? Prayer must be anchored to life. For that prayer which hovers above life but does not touch it is irrelevant to us. It cannot express the feelings, the hopes, the anguish, the hurt, the confidence, the humility which we feel. Actually, this anonymity is a rather modern intervention. The first prayer book, and still the grandest collection of hymns ever compiled, the Book of Psalms, quite unabashedly lists the author of most of his verse. Above every psalm there is a superscription, the Psalm of David, the Psalm of the Sons of Korah, a michtam of Eitan the Ezrahite. Nor did the editor of the Book of Psalms scruple to include verse which is written by men who could not lay claim to credentials of impeccable saintliness. The biographies of the sons of Korah and of Ezra, the Eitan rather, the Ezrahite, are lost to us behind the mists of history. But surely King David is well known. And it is well known that David suffered all the usual passions and anguish of the flesh. Indeed, I would submit that a case can be made that saints simply do not write good soul poetry. The greatest of psalmody must be wrenched out of deep felt experience. It comes out of life, out of our confrontation of the cruelty and the brevity, the hurt, the adventure, the thrill, which is life. Serenity and the calmness, which is the reward of the confidence of the saint, leads to a placidity of verse which silences the muse and which develops a language which is commonplace. I propose this morning briefly to sketch the biography of one of the greatest of the architects of our liturgy, the medieval poet and philosopher, Judah Halevi. I do so with purpose of forethought. I want you to recognize the restless man behind the rising and soaring poetry. I sometimes feel that we moderns are put off by the confidence and the praise, the blessing, which continues page through page of our prayer book. We live in a turbulent and troubled age. In our prayer, our faith has a tentative quality to it, an uncertainty, which seems not to be reflected in these pages. Now, prayer must evoke God. Doubt has no place in prayer. But surely prayer could have more meaning for us if we recognize that each of the authors of prayer himself searched for God, and at times was frustrated in this search, at times had doubts and confusions, not unlike our own. Judah Halevi born in Toledo, the great metropolis of Spain, in the year 1085. At birth, he was given two names. One, the familiar, Judah, the Levite, Judah Halevi. The other, a street name, a marketplace name, Abu el Hassan ibn Alawi. Judah Halevi's day, as in our own, Jewish life was not the entirety of a Jew's life. There was the world of the Ayaman, of the Jewish quarter, of the synagogue, and there was the world of the street and of the city and of the madrasa, the Arab-speaking academy. In the synagogue, Judah Halevi learnt of Torah and he learnt of Talmud, he learnt Hebrew. In the madrasa, he learnt of the prince of philosophers, Aristotle. He learnt the medicine and the science of Galen and of Hippocrates. He learnt the full range of beauty and of cultivation, which was Islamic civilization at its height. And he learned to write Arabic verse. Now this twin heritage, one spiritual, one secular, is not unlike the heritage of our own children today. And as it is today, so it was then. This gave to the young Jewish child a doubly enriched cultural inheritance. But it also, as today, set up ambivalence, tension in his soul. Which world should be his? Each world had its beauty, each was enticing, but many of the values were not translatable, not congruent. In the synagogue, he learned of God, of a God who was near unto those who called upon him, of a loving father who watched tenderly over the fate of his dispersed people. In the madrasa, he learned of God. But the God of the madrasa was more of a logical necessity, the unmoved mover, the first cause, that which brought all of nature into being, without which natural law could not be explained. In the synagogue, he learned of spiritual history. In the synagogue, he learned of the law of gentle kindness. He learned of responsibility. In the madrasa, he learned of the richness of civilization. He learned of man's determined and ruthless search for truth, for knowledge. He learned to set the search for truth even above man's humane responsibility. Which world should be his own? Each had a rich inheritance to give him. Not unlike most of our children, he opted first for the larger world without. And as a young medical student, a man gifted with verse and with a gentle voice, he poured out in verse, Arabic verse, all the usual joy and enthusiasm of the young in their strength and in the world's grandeur. He spoke of love, of the enticing eyes and the black hair of a succession of sweethearts, of wine and of gentle company, of the bracing quality of an early morning swim, of the thrill that comes to the young, the hot rodders of the day, as they drove their galloping steeds across the countryside. He sang happily, Abu el Hassan did, and he sang in Arabic of all the familiar themes of youth. But slowly, Judah Halevi began to appear in the body of Abu el Hassan. We cannot know why. Perhaps it was that being a physician, he began to brush up against, in his daily rounds, the twin cruelties of pain and death. Perhaps these sobered him. We cannot tell, but sure it is that one of the first of his Hebrew verses, the first indication he gives us that he is dependent upon a power beyond himself, is this simple physician's prayer. Sami merkachi lecha, ben tov ben ra, ben chazak ben rafe, ata asher tivcha, velo ani. My medicines are of thee, O God, whether for healing or for hurt, effective or weak. It is thou who determines, not I. But Abu son did not wish to become Judah Halevi. He delighted in his irresponsibility. He delighted in his thirst for life. And he threw up his medical practice. He gave up his internship. He left Toledo. And for a year or more, he walked the highways and the byways of southern Spain, a practicing professional troubadour, a minstrel, whose verse and whose voice was for hire at weddings and celebrations. And we have in the anthology of Judah Halevi's poetry, which has come down to us, a dozen or more wedding songs ground out for the entertainment of those who feasted and roisted in the early 12th century. Abu al-Hasan sought to escape from Judah Halevi, but he could not make good his escape. Every once in a while, when he set his pen down on paper, he wrote Hebrew. He wrote in a more mature and sober vein. Yeshena b'chek yaldut, asleep is the heart of youth. How long wilt thou slumber? Know that youthful innocence must be put aside. Childhood ends. So arise, set out. Recognize the presence of age and its burden of wisdom. Finally, the wild oats having been combed out of his hair, this young physician came back from the grand tour, hung up his harp, left off attending the hootenannies of Toledo and Seville, and returned to responsibility. He settled down to his practice, he married, began to raise a family, and for over a decade his pen and his poesy was dry. No verse flowed from him. There was no happiness in his soul. He was betwixt and between, a stranger to both worlds. So slowly, somehow one day, Judah Halevi woke up, and he was but one man, a whole man, at home and warm in his faith. And the first indication he had of this warmth, this rightness of faith, was that the holidays and the holy days, the Sabbaths, began to feel part of himself, no longer an imposed external discipline. And the first verse of this period is verse which speaks with joy and great pleasure of the observance of the sanctities of our religious life. Six slaves, the weekday's hour. I share with them a round of toil and care. Yet light the burden seems. I bear it for thy sweet sake, Sabbath my fair. 'Tis dusk. With sudden light distilled from one sweet presence, the world is filled. The tumult of my heart is stilled, for thou art come, Sabbath my fair. Indeed, it is true that though most of us believe that faith is the achievement of a mental exercise, that it is the end point of a pilgrimage in logic, in fact, faith comes to us beyond philosophy, beyond logic. It creeps up on us. And the first indication we have that we are at peace and at one with our God is that we are at one with our people and at one with its prayer. And that is why I can never answer the seemingly simple question so often put to me. Rabbi, what is the sure way to faith? Give me a book. Give me a book that sets down the reasons that I should believe. I cannot. The reasons are not in a book. They are beyond words. We come to faith by sensing the mystery and the miracle without. Teach me, Rabbi, to sense this miracle. How can I? I do not know of what miracle you will be sensitive. There are some who stand reverent and mute before the sheer fact of life, and some who see only a bit of irritated protoplasm under the microscope. There are some who are reverent before the expanding infinity of the heavens, and some who see only the gaseous diffusion of simple elements. There are some who rejoice and see God's hands and man's ascent from beast to man, from jungle to civilization. And others who see only the iron laws of natural selection. I do not know your peculiar emotional context. Each of us is built with a different emotional architecture. But I do know this, that each of us at some times finds himself overwhelmed with a sense of his own smallness before a grandness, a power, a mind beyond. Faith creeps up on us. O Lord, where shall I find thee? Yah, ana emtsaha. Makomcha na'ala v'ne'elam. Ana lo emtsaha. Kvodcha male olam. O Lord, where shall I find thee? High and hid is thy lofty place. And where shall I not find thee whose glory fills all space? Longing I sought thy presence. Lord, with my whole heart did I pray. Coming out toward thee, I found thee coming my way. Faith is beyond logic, but faith does not deny logic. As it was with all of the young men of his day, Halevi in his early youth had been tutored expertly in the categories of Aristotle's logical canon. He knew Greek physics and Greek metaphysics, all that passed in his day for logic. Indeed, in his later life, he wrote one of the great medieval philosophic texts of Judaism, the Khuzari, or the Khazars. The Khazars were a group of Asian nomads who in the 9th century or so had been converted to Judaism. And Halevi calls this book the Khazars or the Khuzari because he imagines a debate in the tents of Buran, the Khazar king, in which a haver, a rabbi, a Muslim imam and a Christian priest lay before this seeker after a new faith, their wares, and he of course chooses Judaism. Now in this philosophic work, the Khuzari, Judah Halevi used the tools of logic to destroy most of the convenient and conventional assumptions of medieval philosophy. In his day, he was called an obscurantist, a denier of fact and of truth. But what he did do was to insist that logic was not a neat world unto itself like mathematical symbols, but that philosophy must grow out of the living experience. And what Halevi said these many centuries ago has become the foundation stone of each and every school of modern thought. Philosophy exists as part of life, not as an imaginary mental construct. Halevi did not reject truth. He only insisted that fact and philosophy be seen in proper context. And he believed that this proper context was spiritual and flowed out of our religious and biblical tradition. But let us move for a moment from the singer to the song. As a man in his middle 30s, at home now in his faith, Halevi used his great poetic talent to express and to expose the whole gamut of feelings which coursed in the Jewish soul. Pride in a grand and noble heritage. Humility before the creator of the universe. Fear at the dispersion, at the smallness of the Jewish community within the larger context of power without. Halevi lived at the beginning of the medieval midnight. During Halevi's lifetime, two crusades coursed down the Rhineland on their way to the Holy Land and left behind a red river of Jewish blood. Halevi saw the hard hand of cruelty and hate fastening itself upon the dispersed community. And he sang to the Jewish people of God and of hope. Lo, sun and moon, these ministers eternal given to Jacob's seed, the signs that they shall ever be a nation. Lo, let us not cry despairing, nay, nor say hope faileth, and our strength is near to die. Let us believe that we shall be always, nor cease until there be nor night nor day. And what was the context of this hope? The context was the Holy Land. Judah Halevi was the first Zionist poet. He drew a whole barrel full of verse inspiration from the Bible. He walked the biblical way in his mind. He rejoiced in each and every nook and cranny of Israel. And more than that, he foresaw the time when Israel would be reborn in Hebrew freedom, and where the millennial dispersion of the people would be obviated by a new Jewish state. He was this sweet singer of Zion. O Zion, still the beauty crowned, sad captive though thou art, to thee in fervent love is bound thy children's steadfast heart. Their joy was theirs, and theirs is now thy woe, and for thy wounds their tears incessant flow. As prisoners long for light and air, for thee thine exiles yearn, when bowed before God's throne in prayer, still towards thy gates they turn, or banned and hunted over hill and dale, tell of thy palm tree's shade, a wistful tale. Like an ill dream, the hosts of wrong pass utterly away. Thy prophet's word, thy Levite song, shall last forever and aye. Desired, thou wast God's dwelling place to be. Happy the man he grants to abide with thee. Yea, happy he that hopes and waits, and sees with mortal eyes thy light break through the orient gates, thy new dawn mount the skies, who witness thy chosen one's reward, and joys in thy joy over youth restored. Now, every faith must have its commitment. Halevi's long poetic association with the geography and the meaning of Israel led him to make late on in his life a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, difficult though this was in those days. And on this pilgrimage, this poet of Zion disappears off of the scene of history. Legend has it that he died pierced by an Arab lance before the very gates of the holy city. But this is legend. Certain it is that in this pilgrimage, he symbolized the new nexus of Israel to Israel, of the people to the land. And as our people reread in their synagogues through the long pilgrimage of medieval tears of the poetry of Halevi, they longed for Zion. He kindled Zion's fire in their hearts, a fire which flames so brightly in our own day. And what of us? What shall we make of this grand biography? Shall we not see the man behind the verse? Shall we not see the kind of men who poured their faith into the prayers which we speak? Can we not see how we too can come to faith? He walked the way. He came to faith. We walk the way, and surely too someday the words shall be ours. O Lord, where shall I find thee? High and hidden is thy place, and where shall I not find thee? Whose glory fills all space. Longing I sought thy presence. Lord, with my whole heart did I pray. Going out toward thee, I found thee coming my way.